Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic, all of them published in November of 2024. I hope you enjoy the program today. This first article comes to us from the ideas section of the magazine. We're just going to have to deal with him. Europe braces for Trump, by McKay Coppins. On the record, we're as calm can be, a European official assured me last week when I asked him to ask what he thought about the re-election of Donald Trump. His answer surprised me. I'd first met the official earlier this year when I was reporting on European allies' view of the U.S. presidential election. Back then, almost every leader and diplomat I interviewed expressed dread at the prospect of Trump's return to power. This same official had described the stakes as existential for his country. The reasons for the anxiety were obvious. Russia was waging war on NATO's doorstep, and America, the alliance's most powerful member by far, appeared to be on the verge of re-electing a president who had, among other things, said he'd encouraged Russia to do whatever the hell they want, quote, to NATO countries he considers freeloaders. Yet now the official on the other end of the line was talking optimistically about the transatlantic cooperation his government looked forward to fostering with its partners in Washington, and working toward strong relationships with the new administration. We approach the next Trump presidency with calm and focus, not wobbling and panic, he confidently declared. Then he asked if he could speak anonymously. I agreed. Obviously, he said, a million things could go wrong. Political leaders and diplomats across Europe are clear-eyed about the threat that the next president will pose, and yet they can do very little about it. The overall level of anxiousness is fairly high, the official told me. People are expecting turbulence. America's allies now know they can't simply ride out a Trump term and wait for a snap back to normalcy. So far this century, Americans have elected George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, and Trump again. Predictability is gone, he said. The pendulum swings from one extreme to the other. In the short term, sources told me, the plan is to cozy up to Trump and those close to him and hope for the best. In the long term, a growing consensus has emerged that Europe will need to prepare for a world in which it no longer counts on America for protection. Wolfgang Ischinger, a veteran German diplomat who has served as ambassador to the United States, is among those urging calm. He has publicly cautioned European leaders against finger-wagging in their interactions with the president-elect, and said they should take a wait-and-see approach when it comes to Trump's foreign policy. Like other Europeans I spoke with, he was relieved by the choice of Marco Rubio, who has signaled support for NATO and has traditional views of America's role in the world for Secretary of State. Ischinger also welcomed the realism that has shaped Europe's response so far to Trump's re-election. We're just going to have to deal with him. We're prepared to deal with him. European officials who have spent years planning for this contingency are working to deepen personal relationships with Trump's Republican allies, Ischinger told me, and talking about gestures they could make to flatter him. But these efforts will almost certainly face resistance from the European public, which he said broadly finds Trump repellent and even sinister. I see a lot of disdain and panic, he told me. These reactions were reflected in the post-election headlines in the European press, which greeted Trump's return with a mix of bafflement, scorn, and apprentice puns. What have they done? Again? Asked the cover of Britain's Daily Mirror. The Guardian plastered its cover with the words, American Dread. And an op-ed on the home page of the German newspaper Die Zeit resorted to English to capture the moment with a four-letter headline, Fuck. Behind the scenes, Ischinger told me European leaders have discussed inviting Trump to a capital for a grand state visit where allies could roll out the red carpet and hopefully cultivate some goodwill. But Ischinger worries that such an attempt could backfire. I cannot imagine any such scenario in any German, French, Spanish, Italian city where you would not have huge anti-Trump demonstrations, probably really ugly ones, he told me. Organizing a decent visit for Mr. Trump would really be quite a nightmare for the police. Ischinger told me that the return of Trump and his hard-edged America First policy is emboldening Europeans who have been arguing that the continent needs more independence from its most powerful ally. Ischinger himself seems to be listening. When we spoke earlier this year, he was somewhat dismissive of the idea that Europe could chart a post-America course, at least in the near term. Dreaming about strategic autonomy for Europe is a wonderful vision for maybe the next 50 years, he told me in March, but right now, we need America more than ever. Last week, though, he spoke urgently of the need for Europe to start manufacturing more of its own weapons and get serious about being able to defend its borders. Are we finally going to wake up to the fact that we cannot rely forever on being protected by the United States? He asked. He said he doesn't believe that Trump will move to withdraw from NATO, but the fact that it's even a question puts Europe in a deeply precarious position. The U.S. has more troops stationed in Europe, about 85,000, than the entire militaries of Belgium, Sweden, and Portugal combined. It provides essential air force, intelligence gathering, and ballistic missile defense capabilities, covers about 16% of NATO's operating costs, and manufactures most of the weapons that are bought by European militaries. Ischinger said that the situation is untenable. It's just too risky to rely indefinitely on American military might to deter Russian aggression in the region. We have a war now. This is urgent. This is not just political theory, he told me. This is a decisive moment in European history. Meanwhile, some in Europe are looking beyond the immediate military implications of Trump's election. At Faith Angle Europe, an annual conference hosted last week by the Aspen Institute in France, journalists and scholars from both sides of the Atlantic gathered in a resort on the French Riviera, and in between pastry buffets and dips in the pool, contemplated the potential end of liberal democracy in America. To many in Europe, Trump's election looks less like a historical fluke or black swan event, and more like the climactic achievement of a right-wing populism that has been upending politics on their continent for much of this century, the same forces that led to Brexit in the United Kingdom, brought Giorgia Meloni to power in Italy, and made Marine Le Pen a major player in France. Not all Europeans, of course, are put off by the brand of politics that Trump represents. Natalie Tosi, an Italian political scientist who has worked as an advisor for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the European Union, predicted that Trump's victory would galvanize far-right movements around the world. They feel they really are on a roll, and they probably are, she told attendees at the conference. There's a sense of legitimization. If this is happening in the heart of liberal democracy, surely you can't make the argument that this happening in Europe is undemocratic. In recent years, Tosi said, far-right leaders in Europe were on their best behavior, eager not to alienate America by, say, airing their real views about Putin and Ukraine. Now that Biden, a classic transatlanticist, is set to be replaced with Trump, she said, there's going to be quite a lot of lowering of the masks. Bruno Mackehis, a writer and consultant on geopolitics who has served as Portugal's Europe minister, told me his phone had been ringing constantly since Trump's election. European business leaders want to know what Trump will do with his second term and how they can prepare. Mackehis was not optimistic. He scoffed at Trump's decision to create new, lofty-sounding administration posts for Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, and was baffled by the Silicon Valley types who believe the billionaires will transform the federal government, usher in a new era of unprecedented economic growth, and colonize Mars. Maybe, Mackehis said, I don't know. But if you saw this in another country, you would see it as an acute sign of political decay when billionaires and oligarchy are taking over political policy. Mackehis, like others I talked with, was eager not to be seen as hysterical or fatalistic. He said he didn't think Trump's foreign policy appointments so far have been disastrous. But when he looked at the people Trump was naming to key domestic positions, most notably Matt Gaetz as Attorney General, he found it hard to see anything other than a profound deterioration of political culture and democratic norms. Americans have more reason to worry than the rest of the world, he said. And that completes the first article, We're Just Going to Have to Deal with Him, by Atlantic staff writer McKay Coppins. This next article comes to us from the culture section. The title is The Thin Line Between Biopic and Propaganda. The success of Reagan reflects the market demands of a more fragmented, movie-going public and reality, by Zach Schoenfeld. At its best, a presidential biopic can delve into the monomaniacal focus and potential narcissism that might drive a person to run for the White House in the first place. That's what Oliver Stone did in 1995's Nixon, dramatizing the 37th president's downfall with the exhilarating paranoia of the director's best work. Though guilty of some fact-fudging, Stone retained empathy for Richard Nixon's childhood trauma and lifelong inferiority complex, delivering a Shakespearean tragedy filtered through a grim vision of American power. As Nixon, played by a hunched, scotch-guzzling Anthony Hopkins, stalks the halls of a White House engulfed by scandal, and stews with jealousy at the late John F. Kennedy, the president never seemed so lonely. A presidential biopic can also zoom in on a crucial junction in a leader's life. Steven Spielberg's Lincoln explored its protagonist's fraught final months, during which he pushed at great political risk for a constitutional amendment to abolish slavery. Spielberg's film was captivating because it didn't just recreate Lincoln's famous speeches, but also imagined what the man was like behind the scenes, in backroom dealings, or in contentious confrontations with his wife, Mary Todd. like its 1939 predecessor, Young Mr. Lincoln, the film wisely limits its scope. Focusing on a pivotal period proves a defter approach than trying to capture the full sprawl of a president's life, a task better left to hefty biographies. And then there's a movie like this year's Reagan, the Ronald Reagan biopic starring Dennis Quaid. Reagan is a boyhood-to-grave survey of the 40th president's life and administration, with a chest-beating emphasis on his handling of the Cold War that blurs the line between biopic and Hollywood boosterism. Filmed with all the visual panache of an arthritis medication commercial, the movie is suffocating in its unflagging reverence for its titular hero. In its portrayal of Reagan's formative years, secondary characters seem to exist primarily to give mawkish pep talks or to fill the young Reagan's brain with somber warnings about the evils of communism. "God has a purpose for your life, something only you can do," his mother tells him after he reads scripture at church. Later in college, he is disturbed by a speech from a Soviet defector who visits a local congregation and lectures wide-eyed students that they will not find a church like this in the USSR. Unlike Lincoln, the film seems incapable of imagining what its protagonist was like in private moments, or ascribing any interior complexity to him. Even his flirty exchanges with his wife Nancy feel like they were cribbed from a campaign ad. "I just want to do something good in this world," he tells his future spouse on a horseback riding date. "Make a difference." The portrayal isn't helped by the fact that the 70-year-old Quaid is digitally de-aged and delivers his lines in a tinny imitation of the politician's voice. A bizarre narrative device further detaches the audience from Reagan's perspective. The entire movie is narrated by John Voight, doing a Russian accent, as a fictionalized KGB agent who surveilled Reagan for decades and is now regaling a young charge with stories of how one American president outsmarted the Soviet Union. They say history is written by the winners, but sometimes the winners like to put on a bad accent and cosplay as the losers. Yet despite heavily negative reviews, Reagan remained in theaters for nearly 2 months and earned a solid $30 million at the box office, playing to an underserved audience and tapping into some of the cultural backlash that powered Donald Trump's re-election. The film's success portends a strange new era for the presidential biopic, one in which hokey hagiography might supplant any semblance of character growth, reinforcing what audiences already want to hear about politicians they already admire. In retrospect, Lincoln, with its innate faith in the power of government to do good, was as much a product of the Obamacare era, that surge of positivity and optimism that flooded pop culture beginning in the early 2010s. As Lin-Manuel Miranda's Broadway smash Hamilton. But the arrival of the Trump era threw cold water on those feel-good vibes, and since Lincoln, presidential biopics have largely failed to connect with crowds. Two lightweight depictions of Barack Obama's young adulthood arrived in 2016, but neither reckoned with his complicated presidency. In 2017, Rob Reiner delivered the ambivalent and uneven LBJ, which sank at the box office and made little impression on audiences. Meanwhile, Martin Scorsese developed and seemingly abandoned a Teddy Roosevelt biopic. In development for more than a decade, Reagan emerges from a more plainly partisan perspective. Its producer, Mark Joseph, once called The Reagans, the 2003 TV movie starring James Brolin, insulting to the former president. Though Reagan director Sean McNamara expressed hope that his film would unite people across political lines, its source material, The Crusader, is a book by Paul Kengor, a conservative who has written 8 books about Reagan and who presently works at a right-wing think tank. And its star, Dennis Quaid, is among Hollywood's most prominent Trump supporters. In July, Quaid appeared on Fox News Live from the Republican National Convention, proclaiming that Reagan would help Americans born after 1985 get a glimpse of what this country was. The notable presidential biopics of the past were prestige pictures that at least tried to appeal to a wide swath of the movie-going public across political spectrums. Even 2008's W, Stone's spiritual sequence to Nixon, inferior by far and disappointingly conventional in its biographical beats, is hardly the liberal excoriation many viewers might have expected from the director. It was even criticized for going too easy on George W. Bush. Released during the waning years of his presidency, when Bush banging was low-hanging fruit for audiences, the film portrays the 43rd president as a lovable screw-up with crippling daddy issues. As Timothy Noah argued in Slate at the time, W is the rare Oliver Stone film that had to tone down the historical record because the truth was too lurid. Instead, new entries like Reagan and Ali Abbasi's The Apprentice, the more nuanced film, reflect the market demands of a more fragmented, movie-going public and reality. Rarely do two movies about the same era of American history have so little audience overlap. Set from 1973 to 1986, The Apprentice portrays Trump, Sebastian Stan, as a young sociopath in training, dramatizing his rise to business mogul and his relationship with mentor Ray Cohn, played by Jeremy Strong, a Svengali of capitalist chicanery, molding a monster in his own image. In the most shocking scenes, the film depicts Trump brutally raping his wife Ivana and undergoing liposuction surgery. Ivana accused Trump of rape in a 1990 divorce deposition, then recanted the allegation decades later. Trump's campaign has called the movie a malicious defamation. The film, in other words, gives confirmation and a sleazily gripping origin story to those who already believe Trump is a malevolent con man and irredeemable misogynist. It knows what its viewers want. So seemingly does Reagan, which shows its protagonist primarily as the great communicator who tore down that wall. But as the Reagan biographer Max Boot recently wrote, the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Soviet Union were primarily the work of Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, two consequences of his radically reformist policies. Reagan did not bring about Gorbachev's reforms, much less force the collapse of the Soviet Union. Reagan resists such nuance, hewing instead to a predictable hero's narrative. Soviet leaders are swathed in visuals cliches, grotesque men sipping vodka in cigar-filled rooms. Meanwhile, the film renders Reagan's domestic critics without sophistication or dignity. As Matthew Dalek chronicles in his book, The Right Moment, Reagan spent much of his 1966 campaign to become California's governor sensationalizing and condemning marches protesting the Vietnam War at UC Berkeley, and later called for a, quote, bloodbath against the campus left. In the film, we see Reagan as the state's governor, calling in the National Guard to crack down on Berkeley protesters. But we never learn what these students are protesting. Vietnam is scarcely referenced. A nastier incident in which Reagan sent cops in riot gear open fire on student protesters and killed one goes unmentioned. A less slanted film might have interrogated the conflict between Reagan's anti-totalitarian Cold War rhetoric and his crackdown on demonstrators at home. It might also have reckoned with the president's devastating failure to confront the AIDS epidemic, a fact that movie only fleetingly references, via a few shots of ACT up demonstrators slotted into a generic montage of Reagan critics set to Genesis' Land of Confusion. But Reagan remains tethered to the great man theory of history, in which Reagan single-handedly ended the Cold War, preserved America's standing in the world, and beat back lefty communist sympathizers. A match-cut transition from a shot of newly retired Reagan swinging an axe at his ranch to young wall peckers taking axes to the Berlin Wall in 1989 literalizes the message for grade school viewers. The Gipper brought down the wall himself. It's not that the movie is too kind to Reagan, but by flattering him in this way, it robs him of the conflicts and contradictions that made him a figure worth thinking about today. In this way, too, Reagan forms a curious contrast to Nixon. A central message of Stone's film is that even if Nixon had wanted to end the Vietnam War, he was powerless to act against the desires of the deep state, or the beast, as Hopkins Nixon calls it. In a defining scene, a young anti-war demonstrator confronts the president. "You can't stop it, can you?" she realizes. "Because it's not you, it's the system. The system won't let you stop it." Nixon is stunned into stammering disbelief. Indeed, Stone's trilogy of films about U.S. presidents, JFK, Nixon, and W., all reflect some paranoia about the dark forces of state power. The unabashedly conspiratorial JFK suggests that Kennedy was eliminated by the CIA and/or the military-industrial complex because he didn't fall in line with their covert objectives. They are stories of ambitious leaders whose presidencies were hijacked or truncated by forces beyond their comprehension. Movies whose villains are shadowy figures operating within the bowels of the U.S. government. It's not just Stone's view of state power that makes his films more interesting. It's that he takes into account forces larger than one man, regardless of that man's own accomplishments. Reagan's vision of the institution is more facile. Its hero is endowed with near-mythical power to end wars and solve domestic woes. Its villains are as clearly labeled as a map of the Kremlin. The film's simplistic pandering vaporizes complexity and undercuts the cinematic aims of a presidential biopic. It's a profitable film because it instead adheres to the market incentives of modern cable news. Tell viewers what they want to hear and give them a clear and present enemy. In his 2011 book, The Reactionary Mind, the political theorist Corey Robin argues that the end of the Cold War had proven unkind to the conservative movement by depriving it of a distinct enemy. For today's GOP, a good adversary is hard to find. In the past few years, its leaders have grasped around haphazardly in search of one. Trans people, Haitian immigrants, childless women, and as always, Hillary Clinton. In Reagan, though, the world is much simpler. There's an evil empire 5,000 miles away, and a California cowboy is the only man who can beat it. It's a flat narrative fix for one of his old B-movies. That's the end of the article. The author, Zach Schoenfeld, is a freelance journalist and critic based in New York. He was formerly a senior writer at Newsweek. The title of his article was The Thin Line Between Biopic and Propaganda. And I'll take just a moment to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by SunSounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your SunSounds volunteer reader. I'm reading from the online edition of The Atlantic. The articles I'm reading have all been published in November of 2024. I'll continue on with this article from the family section. It's not something you really want to hear, something I didn't want to hear, but the title is Get Ready for Higher Food Prices. Trump vowed to lower food prices. His policies will almost certainly do the opposite. By Ellen Cushing. When Americans went to the polls last week, they wanted cheaper food. Groceries really are more expensive than they used to be, and grocery costs are how many Americans make sense of the state of the economy at large. In September, Pew Research Center reported that three-quarters of Americans were very concerned about them. And this month, many of those people voted for Donald Trump, the candidate who touted his distance from the economic policy of the last 4 years, and who promised repeatedly to lower prices. But two of Trump's other big promises, mass deportations of undocumented immigrants and more restrictive trade regulations, would almost certainly raise food prices, economists told me. American-grown staples would get more expensive owing to a domestic labor shortage, and imported foods would too, because they would be subject to double-digit import taxes. This cause-and-effect dynamic could be my final exam, Rachel Friedberg, who teaches principles of economics at Brown University, told me. It's just very straightforward principles of economics. The main issue is labor. American farming depends on undocumented workers. If the Trump administration were to enact the largest deportation operation in American history, and that's in quotes, and deport every undocumented immigrant living in the United States, somewhere between 40% and 50% of the people who plant our crops and pick our fruit would leave the domestic workforce. Proponents of immigration enforcement typically say these jobs could be taken by documented or American-born workers. But the farm industry is already in a prolonged labor crisis, and undocumented immigrants tend to be willing to work for less money. That's why employers hire them, even though it's illegal. Fewer workers mean higher wages, means higher prices, straight up. Some farms might be able to get by shorthanded, at least for a little while. Some might embrace technology more quickly, investing in automated systems that could help fill the labor gap. But that would take time. And as David Anderson, a Texas A&M University agricultural economist, told me, you gotta get the cows milked and fed every day. America's agricultural system relies on hands and feet, arms and legs, day in and day out. If the Trump administration does, in fact, deport millions of people, produce prices would likely increase the most, Bradley Rickard, an agricultural economist at Cornell University, told me in an email, because labor represents a significant share of total costs. Prices would probably go up quickest and most dramatically for the crops that are most labor-intensive to harvest, strawberries, mushrooms, asparagus, cherries. So would those for the foods farmed in California, which grows three-quarters of the fruits and nuts, and a third of the vegetables produced domestically, and is home to about half of the country's undocumented agricultural workers. Mass deportations would also drive up prices for dairy and meat, whose industries have also been in a labor shortage for at least the past half decade. According to a 2022 analysis from the American Immigration Council, which advocates for immigrants and seeks to shape immigration policy, a scarcity of workers led the median wage in the dairy and meat sectors to increase 33.7% from 2019 to 2022, and prices to rise between 4.5% and 7%. In 2015, Anderson and some colleagues conducted a survey on behalf of the dairy industry and found that eliminating immigrants from the sector would reduce production, put farms out of business, and cause retail milk prices to increase by about 90%. Anderson's study is 10 years old and assumed a total loss of all immigrant labor, documented and undocumented. Last week, he told me he has no reason to believe the dynamic wouldn't hold to a lesser degree if a smaller amount of the workforce were deported now. We wouldn't be able to produce all the stuff that we do today. Less production means less supplies, he said, and less supplies means food prices will go up. Immigration policy affects food that is grown domestically, but about 15% of the American food supply is imported, including about 60% of fresh fruit, 80% of seafood, 90% of avocados, and 99% of coffee. Our reliance on or taste for imported goods has ticked up steadily over the past few decades, as we have become accustomed to Italian olive oil and raspberries in winter. On the campaign trail, Trump proposed taxing these and all imported goods in an attempt to raise domestic production and to reduce the deficit. If his plan goes through, Chinese imports, which include large amounts of fish, seafood, garlic, spices, tea, and apple juice we consume, would be subject to 60% to 100% tariffs. All other imports would be subject to 10% to 20% tariffs. Those taxes would be passed on to consumers, especially in the short term, as domestic production ramps up, if it can ramp up, and especially if undocumented immigrants are simultaneously leaving the workforce. There's no safety valve, Marcus Nolan, the executive vice president and director of studies at the nonpartisan think tank Peterson Institute for International Economics, told me. If you start deporting people, it's not like you can import the product and make up for it if you have these tariffs. We all need food to live, and all food needs to come from somewhere. The process by which it makes to our plate is complicated, resource-intensive, and subject to the vagaries of policy, weather, disease, and labor supply. The system does not have a large amount of slack built into it. If sticker-shocked milk fans start gravitating toward other drinks, those prices will also go up. If California's berry industry is squeezed by a labor shortage, and the market for imported berries is squeezed by tariffs, berries will cost more. And although farms are the biggest employer of undocumented workers, these workers are also a major part of the mechanism that processes, butchers, cooks, and delivers our food, from the sprawling poultry processing plants of the South to the local fried chicken place. The restaurant industry, which employs more than 800,000 undocumented immigrants, according to a Center for American Progress analysis, is already struggling to fill jobs, which is driving higher prices. Even a small reduction in the workforce would increase operating costs, which will almost definitely result in either restaurants closing or costs being passed on to eaters. The immigration and tariff policies, in other words, would affect all the food we eat. Snacks, school lunches, lattes, pet food, fast food, fancy restaurant dinners. People will not stop eating if food gets more expensive. They will just spend more of their money on it. Trump's team proposed deportations and tariffs as a way to fix America's inflation-addled economy. But voters are unlikely to be comforted by what they see over the next few years. Toward the end of our call, I asked Friedberg if she could see any scenario under which, if the new administration's policies are enacted, prices don't go up. No, she said, without pausing. I am extremely confident that food will get more expensive. Buy those frozen vegetables now. That completes the article. The title was Get Ready for Higher Food Prices by Atlantic staff writer Ellen Cushing. The next article's title is Making Government Efficient Again. An incoming Trump administration plans to ransack the civil service, but it needs reform, not demolition, by Robert Beschel, Jr. Although the plight of America's 2.2 million federal bureaucrats seldom elicits public sympathy, spare a charitable thought for their future. Not since the congressional elections of 1882 has civil service reform received so much political attention. President-elect Donald Trump and his allies now face a fundamental decision. Will they listen to the loudest and most extreme voices in their party and be agents of chaos and disruption in upending the civil service? Or will they adopt a more measured, incremental approach that would deliver improvements and burnish their managerial credentials? The recent appointment of Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy to lead the newly minted Department of Government Efficiency is a clear signal that Trump is leaning toward disruption. But the risks are significant, and the president-elect has other reform options that could be more effective at a far lower cost. Few would argue that the current federal service civil service is perfect. In 2017 and 2018, the National Academy of Public Administration, an independent nonprofit chartered by Congress, issued a two-part white paper describing the government's staffing system as fundamentally broken, with too many rules and too little flexibility. Its authors argued that firing non-performers and attracting new talent can be too difficult. Other observers have bemoaned the bureaucracy for its cost, inefficiency, and unresponsiveness. Change is clearly needed, and would in fact be welcome in many corners of the federal government. Although distinguished bipartisan commissions may agree on a path forward, Republican and Democratic politicians, buffeted by the interests and passions of their bases, have been unable to come together to address these problems. Under pressure from public sector unions, Democrats have shied away from even modest reforms of their own and have focused instead on resisting GOP proposals, which have centered on removing protections from federal employees. Some on the hard right are working toward deconstruction of the administrative state and the total destruction of the deep state, as the former Trump strategist Steve Bannon has put it. But most Americans, including many moderate Republicans and Democrats, do not share this animus. They value government services and simply want to see them perform better. Efficient and effective institutions are easy to degrade, difficult to build. The United States needs to retain the benefits of technical competence and impartial advice from a meritocratic civil service while ensuring that federal employees are accountable to political oversight. There are more constructive ways to achieve the objectives that both Republicans and Democrats claim to want, while retaining a high-performing, meritocratic civil service. Last in his first administration, Trump used an executive order to introduce Schedule F, which sought to remove civil service protections from any career official with a policymaking role, giving the White House much greater discretion in hiring and firing. Currently, there are about 4,000 political positions, out of which some 1,200 are subject to congressional approval. The number of positions that could be designated as Schedule F is unknown, but estimates suggest it could be 50,000 or higher. Trump's campaign pledged to immediately reissue my 2020 executive order, restoring the president's authority to remove rogue bureaucrats, and he himself has promised to wield this power very aggressively. He will have broad support from his party, which has sought to reap political benefit from stoking public hostility towards civil servants. In 2023, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, then a presidential primary candidate, claimed that he would start slitting throats of federal bureaucrats from day one. Other prominent Republicans, such as Trump's nominee for Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, have indicated their openness to Schedule F. During the primaries, Ramaswamy denounced the administrative state as an unconstitutional fourth branch of government and proposed firing more than three-quarters of federal employees. He later revised this mass termination plan to cover just half the federal workforce, selected randomly. If your Social Security number ends in an odd number, you're fired. More recently, Ramaswamy has expressed admiration for Musk's drastic staff cuts at X, formerly Twitter, as a template for reducing the federal government. In the Senate, Florida's Rick Scott has been the Republican most aggressively pressing for a radical restructuring of the civil service. In 2022, he rolled out his 12-point Rescue America plan, which included a proposal from many government agencies to either move out of Washington or shut down entirely. Although about 85% of federal employees already work outside the greater Washington, D.C. area, the idea of moving staff out of the Capitol has caught on in Republican circles. The campaign said he would move as many as 100,000 civil service positions to places filled with patriots who love America. Cutting civil service protections is also popular with the MAGA base. The Public Service Reform Act, which Scott introduced last year, proposed to place the entire workforce in at-will employment status, allowing them to be terminated for good cause, bad cause, or no cause at all. The bill has yet passed through committee. And then there is the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025. Tonally, the document is uncompromising. The federal government is a behemoth deployed against American citizens and conservative values. Federal bureaucrats are underworked, overcompensated, and unaccountable. The project argues that the entire edifice of civil service protections is a legacy of the American left. Progressive intellectuals and activists demanded a more professionalized, scientific, and politically neutral administration. That statement is partly accurate, but woefully incomplete. Republicans have historically been at the forefront of reform efforts, and the last major one during the Carter administration was a notably bipartisan affair. Rhetoric aside, the project's analysis of central agencies and federal personnel policy is more subtle and nuanced, grounded in a careful review of the relevant institutions and legal and regulatory frameworks. What influence Project 2025 will have on the second Trump administration remains to be seen. Tactically, the president-elect chose to distance himself from it during the campaign. But in office, Trump may draw heavily on the document, as well as the personnel who drafted it. As Francis Fukuyama has argued, the reintroduction of Schedule F will make the federal government less competent and vastly more politicized. The United States already has a much higher number of political appointees than any other advanced industrial democracy. Nearly 28 times the number in the United Kingdom, for example. Political appointments stretch down 4 or 5 levels of bureaucracy in some agencies, such as the Department of Defense. Republicans would be unwise to view Trump's reelection as a mandate for completely uprooting the civil service. The most recent survey of public confidence in government by the nonpartisan Partnership for Public Service found disturbing evidence of reduced trust in government. Yet attitudes toward federal employees remain positive. A majority of respondents, 55%, agreed with the statement that most civil servants are competent. A similar proportion agreed that most are committed to helping people, like me. Only a quarter of respondents said that presidents should be able to fire any civil servants that they choose for any reason, whereas 72% disagreed with this statement. Several measures could include responsiveness, accountability, and performance at a much lower cost and risk than the ideas currently circulating in Republican circles. Departments and agencies should have more flexibility in managing their human resources and be empowered to tailor their personnel policies to their particular business needs. The allocation of political appointees across the government needs regular review. A bipartisan commission should examine the current 4,000 such posts and make recommendations to the administration about streamlining and redistribution. Performance management is a key area for improvement. Currently, less than 0.5% of the federal workforce is rated marginally satisfactory or unsatisfactory, which at best stretches credence and at worst damages public trust. All government agencies ought to evaluate their staff's performance on a standard curve so that poor delivery is consistently identified and addressed. Adjustments could be made so as not to penalize high-performing agencies and units. Lastly, labor relations in the civil service need an overhaul. The processes and paperwork surrounding termination should be simplified. The window for appeals should be narrowed, and the role of unions in the grievance process for individual employees should be curtailed. Such measures may disappoint the more fervent anti-government voices in today's GOP. But a sober assessment would view Musk's experience with X as a cautionary tale. Although the platform has functioned as a megaphone for its owner, it has also shed users, experienced repeated and embarrassing technical glitches, witnessed steep declines in advertising revenue and may now be worth as little as a fifth of what he paid for it in 2022. In the private sector, such failures fall primarily upon owners and investors. In the public sector, they would affect us all. Do Americans want vital government services, such as food inspection, air traffic control, or Social Security payments, to suffer similar breakdowns? Dislocation and deconstruction may have a visceral appeal among elements of the MAGA base, but once the new Trump administration is in office, the American people will expect it to deliver the public goods and services they rely upon, and do so smoothly, fairly, and efficiently. Disruption may sound trendy in Silicon Valley or tough in conservative think tank circles, but delivery is what will ultimately determine the success or failure of these reforms. That completes the article. The author, Robert Beschel Jr., formerly led the Center of Government Practice at the World Bank, is a senior non-resident fellow with the Middle East Council on Global Affairs. The article's name was Making Government Efficient Again. And that brings the broadcast to an end today. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by SunSounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your SunSound volunteer reader. I hope you enjoyed the program. The articles I've read came from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine, all of them published in November of 2022. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to SunSounds of Arizona, and if you missed an article you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, then click on Demand. That will bring you to a page with all the articles available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.